economy is the exact same fight as a sexual assault survivors or someone who's fighting for access to abortion, I think the faster that we're going to achieve what we're setting out to do.
So when you took the mic at the Tribeca Film Festival yesterday, you said, okay, I'm an activist too, and I got to make our demands. And you're here in New York City, protests at Weill Cornell, if you can explain why. And talk about what's being demanded around surgery. I mean, kind of very different from the anti-trans surgery, where people are calling for, well, as you're saying, bodily autonomy, but also what's happening in New York City that's being weighed right now.
Yeah, so we actually have been making some really good headway in the policy arena. New York City was the first city to pass an ordinance that formally condemned surgeries and outlawed them in New York Health and Hospitals' public health system. It also mandated a public awareness campaign for parents and doctors of intersex children so that they can make better informed decisions than any of our parents were able to, often at the hands of misinformation provided to them by the medical community. We were able to replicate that same ordinance in Austin, Texas. We are the second city in the U.S., the first city in the South, to replicate that ordinance. And actually, we just saw that ordinance scaled to the statewide level. New York State, the New York State Assembly, the New York State Senate, so the entire legislature has scaled that statewide. And so the state of New York is going to be running a public awareness campaign to raise visibility of the existence of people like the three of us and so many others in our movement and that have yet to join our movement, which is really exciting. And I just came from the White House 2 days ago. We've been working with the federal government, with Health and Human Services, and directly with President Biden's White House administration to create the first ever of its kind report on the health inequities faced by our community, including non-consensual surgeries, but also including the little talked about utter dearth and lack of adult health care for intersex individuals in the United States. I have often had to fly to the coasts to receive care at huge personal expense. That is obviously an inequity to people who cannot afford to do something like that. I have run surveys and focus groups across the state of Texas, and we know that Texans are flying quite literally to Japan to receive health care. And so beyond just the surgeries that we experience in our infancy, we can't find doctors that have any idea how to treat our bodies. There's a severe lack of data on what our bodies need to be healthy. There's severe misinformation about what our bodies need to be healthy. And so I'm very excited to be working alongside so many other activists, hand in hand with President Biden's administration to help rectify that.
Finally, we just have 30 seconds, but Julie Cohen, the Oscar-nominated director, what you're hoping to accomplish with this film that's out in theaters on June 30th?
I'd say more openness, more understanding, less shame and secrecy, more pride. You know, people often talk about, like, oh, are you trying to, like, normalize intersex people? That doesn't need to be done. You've just heard from Alicia, River, and Saifa. They are already normal. Understanding that there is a broad spectrum of what normal can be and what beauty and pride can be all about is part of what this film is all about. And I hope it's going to prompt people to want to educate themselves more and to want to feel some pride and joy along with intersex activists who are fighting for their rights after so long.
Well, certainly pride, joy, humor, and also the reality of people's lives featured in this new documentary, Everybody. Julie Cohen, Alicia Rothweigel, River Gayo, Sean Seifert-Wall. I'm Amy Goodman.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we interview attorney Sophia Elijah, the head of the Alliance of Families for Justice.
The Alliance of Families for Justice was founded 7 years ago by attorney Sophia Elijah. Its headquarters are in Harlem. The members of its board and staff are either formerly incarcerated or family members of incarcerated individuals.
We'll also speak with journalist Andrew Perez about the hundreds of millions of dollars that have gone into organizations to push this country to the right.
They've thoroughly corrupted the Supreme Court, which Andrew Perez will tell us all about.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
The Alliance of Families for Justice, the AFJ, was founded 7 years ago by attorney Sophia Elijah. Its headquarters are in Harlem, a community heavily impacted by mass incarceration. AFJ also has satellite offices in Albany and Ithaca. AFJ seeks to heal families and individuals who suffer from their own imprisonment or that of a loved one. It seeks, moreover, to organize and empower them to challenge and change the system of mass incarceration. AFJ's legal support unit provides free legal representation to incarcerated people and their families. AFJ holds weekly community organizing meetings and family empowerment circles and monthly healing circles for formerly incarcerated people. Its organizing and advocacy unit spearheads various campaigns, including one to shut down Attica and another to end felony disenfranchisement. AFJ's Youth Empowerment Project has serviced over 400 New York City young people ages 16 to 24 in its 3-year tenure. All of AFJ's services are free. In New York State, and most places nationwide, incarcerated people lose their voting rights. This is both undemocratic, and because most incarcerated people are Black or Latinx, it is a racist policy and a vestige of Jim Crow laws that permeated New York and most states. The loss of voting rights remains a significant obstacle to criminal justice reform. We speak today with attorney Sophia Elijah. She knows intimately what happens to families whose loved ones are put in prison. She's been able, through the AFJ, to support, motivate, and educate these families to become advocates for civil rights and justice reform. Attorney Elijah has headed legal clinics at the City University of New York's Law School and served as the deputy director of the Criminal Justice Institute at Harvard University under Professor Charles Ogletree. She was the first woman and the first Black executive director of the 170-year-old Correctional Association of New York, where she helped expose and bring to justice several Attica prison guards for brutally beating a man almost to death. In 2016, attorney Sophia Elijah founded the Alliance of Families for Justice. As an author, she has written opinion pieces for the New York Times, the Daily News, and The Hill. She has been honored with the Spirit of John Brown Freedom Award. Sophia Elijah, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Sophia, what was the impetus behind your forming the Alliance of Families for Justice 7 years ago, and why are you based in Harlem?
Well, thanks for asking that question, Michael. Let me start with the second part of it. We're based in Harlem because Harlem is the most impacted community by mass incarceration in all of New York State. In fact, it's known as the Reentry Corridor. I founded Alliance of Families for Justice 7 years ago to meet the needs and fill a gap. Families who had incarcerated loved ones were not part of the narrative at all about criminal justice and prison reform, and they suffer in silence as their loved ones go to prison, and there wasn't anything available to help them transform their pain into power. And that formed the impetus for Alliance of Families for Justice.
Wow. You mentioned that suffering that families go through. Please talk about some of that trauma when a loved one is put in prison.
It's multi-layered, the trauma that families experience. First, you're having someone who you love, who's part of your family, taken away out of the family. That impacts spouses, partners, parents, children, siblings, aunties, the whole family misses that person. That person may also be a source of economic revenue for the family, so that financial support is gone. The role that person may have played is being the person who takes the children to school or helps grandma manage her day. There's a whole host of roles that every family member plays, and people experience their loss. Then there's the economics of going to visit someone, paying for phone calls, paying for packages, paying for commissary. All of those are economic drains on the family.
Sophia, how many families are you currently involved with? And please describe how families are supported by the AJF. And what kind of legal services do you provide?
We have supported thousands and thousands of families. And in fact, Michael, most of the families who benefited from what AFJ does may be people that we never meet, because we take on systemic change with the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision in New York State. And that means that every victory benefits every family that's been impacted by incarceration. There's currently 32,000 people incarcerated in New York, and that's at least 32,000 families that are impacted by the incarceration. But there's also all of the families who previously had incarcerated loved ones who continue to suffer from the trauma of that experience. And our services, all of which are free, benefit all of them as well. Our legal support unit is there to provide free legal representation, advice, and services for people who are currently incarcerated and for family members who have an incarcerated loved one. And they do things like parole prep, clemency prep, challenging conditions inside under which people are forced to exist, dealing with the suspension of visits for family members, and everything in between.
I understand mass incarceration had been on the decline in New York State, but apparently the numbers are going up again. Is that correct? And if so, why?
Yes, the numbers of people incarcerated in New York State starting to go back up. The numbers had been dropping drastically for the past 15 years, from about a high of 72,000 to below 30,000. What also was happening at that same time, the crime rate was dropping. It dropped by over 40%. And so prisons in New York State started being closed. Over 13 prisons in New York State have been closed in the past 15 years. What that meant, though, was that the prison guards union started to get concerned about their jobs. And so they started a very effective PR campaign arguing that the people in prison now were, quote unquote, hyper-violent, and that there needed to be more supervision, more security of these people. And that same narrative spilled over for the police department, because if crime had dropped by 40%, then arguably you didn't need as many police. If there were fewer people in prison and fewer prisons and crime was dropping, then you didn't need as many police and you didn't need as many prison guards. But that meant a loss of jobs for them. And so they changed the narrative drastically and effectively in New York, so that arrest rates have started to go up, criminalization has increased, and more people being sent to prison. And so the rate of increase is about 4% from 2021 to 2022. And I expect that we'll continue to see that for the next few years, unless something changes radically in Albany.
We're speaking with attorney Sophia Elijah. Sophia, let me ask you like the central question. Does the threat of prison really deter crime?
I would argue vociferously that the threat of prison does not deter crime. I'm a criminal defense lawyer by training, have been for over 40 years. The United States and New York in lockstep has been hooked on punishment and burying people alive in prison for decades and decades. The more people we incarcerated, there was no correlation with a decrease in the number of people who were being arrested or committing crimes. So if that's true, then clearly locking people up is not a deterrent to crime. Providing opportunities so that everyone has an equal chance to realize their dreams is the most effective deterrent to crime.
Attorney Sophia Elijah, in your experience, what is a general working definition of the term prison abolition? And what are some of the alternatives to incarceration being proposed?
Well, that's an interesting question, Maria. Let me start with abolition. I would say, first of all, abolition is not an absolute, although some might say that it is. I would say that there are a variety of steps that are necessary to change the mindset and the approach to dealing with what we call human aberrant behavior. So locking people up is something that most abolitionists, I would say all abolitionists, are against. Many abolitionists are also against any forms of police or community supervision or state supervision or intervention in people's lives. There are also abolitionists who argue that the most effective way to address people's needs and their efforts to meet those needs is to provide more opportunities for people. So I'd say there's a spectrum, and there's no absolute definition of abolition other than to agree that there's no benefit to putting people in cages. Alternatives include job development, equal access to resources and opportunities, including education and vocational training, better housing, a fair distribution of public services throughout communities without respect to socioeconomic status. Those are a number of the alternatives that have been proposed, some of which have been implemented. And I would argue that where you've seen robust alternative to incarceration programs in place, that crime rates and incarceration rates have dropped. And those are some of the things that were very effective in New York State to bring those incarceration numbers down so dramatically in the past 15 years.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Attorney Maria Hall, who practices law out in Los Angeles. And Maria and I are speaking with Sophia Elijah, who is the head of the Alliance of Families for Justice, headquartered in Harlem, with satellite offices in Albany and Ithaca. Sophia, what's the average age of prisoners in New York State? Please talk about the need for releasing aging people from prison.
So the average age of the incarcerated population in New York State right now and in about March of 2021 was 40. A few years before that, the average age was 37. So the average age of the incarcerated population is creeping up, and that is the same trend that you find across the country. One of the reasons for this is tougher on crime laws and this I call addiction that we have to punishment in this country, where we never can seem to quite get that pound of flesh and want to keep on extracting more and more years and more pain from someone whose liberty has been taken away. So the reason that there's been a particular focus on people who are aging in prison is the fact that recidivism rates are very low for people who reach about age 45 to 50. They stop to drop dramatically. And if the so-called explanation for why people are incarcerated, they have their liberty taken away, besides the idea of punishment, is public safety, then looking at the statistics with respect to recidivism would show us that as people age out of crime, then that should be taken into consideration and people should be released from prison. In fact, this is an idea that I came up with several years ago when I was working at the Correctional Association, and I shared the idea with Kathy Boudin, our beloved Kathy, and Laura Whitehorn, and Mujahid Farid at that time. And the four of us decided to start an organization called RAP, Release Aging People from Prison, that would focus specifically on that issue and to build a whole campaign around it. And I'm happy to say that RAP has been thriving and done an excellent job in educating our elected officials and members of the parole board about why people who are aging in prison should be released, and to look at the statistics with respect to recidivism and the cost of incarcerating older people.
In New York State, incarcerated people lose their voting rights. What is the position of the Alliance on this? It seems to me that this is both racist and undemocratic.
The Alliance of Families for Justice has a very strong program to restore the right to vote for incarcerated people. The taking away of the right to vote for incarcerated people has its roots in Jim Crow laws dating back hundreds of years in New York State, and in fact, it's baked into the New York State Constitution. So we're part of several coalitions that are working hand in hand to change this law and restore the right to vote for incarcerated people. As I mentioned earlier, there's 32,000 people in New York who are incarcerated. None of them can vote. And there's been some landmark research done by Professor Hedwig Lee that has shown that families who have an incarcerated loved one are far less likely to be civically engaged. So you have not only the people who are doing the time, but their family members who are doing the time with them who are not part of the franchise, and their voices are not being heard and their concerns are not being recognized. So we have a robust effort to do voter education, voter registration, and restore the right to vote for people who are incarcerated.
What are those statistics nationally, Sophia? And secondly, I understand that Florida had voted to restore the right to vote to ex-prisoners, and that's been bottled up. Can you give us the fuller picture on that, please?
I can't give you the statistics nationally other than to say there's just a few states where people who are incarcerated are allowed to vote. That's New Hampshire and Maine, and then the District of Columbia, and then Puerto Rico. Those are the only four places in the United States where people who are incarcerated are allowed to vote. The loss of the right to vote is consistent in all the rest of the states in this country.
Sophia, please talk about our late mutual friend, Kathy Boudin, and what kind of systemic change that you and she envisioned, starting with the mutual understanding that the formerly incarcerated have leadership potential.
Certainly. Well, Kathy and I met back in 1981, and we remained in contact and became really close when she was released from prison. And around that time, I was contemplating starting the Alliance of Families for Justice, and Kathy joined our board of directors. And we talked frequently about the Beyond the Bars conference, which she was so instrumental in starting at Columbia University, and the fact that people who have the lived experience of incarceration also had innate talent, knowledge, wisdom, and leadership ability, and that they needed to be provided with those opportunities to have a seat at the table, to have the microphone, to decide the issues of concern and the strategies to be pursued. And that thinking and that outlook is very much at the heart of Alliance of Families for Justice and how we function. And Kathy and I used to spend hours and hours and hours talking about the way to steer Alliance of Families for Justice, but more broadly, the way to shape the narrative around incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people and their families.
Sophia, please talk about the systemic change that you and Kathy Boudin would discuss.
We focused a lot on policies and practices that were in place by the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, known as DOCS, here in New York. So we talked about visiting procedures and practices. We talked about the provision of PPE during the COVID pandemic. We talked about the restoration of the right to get married, because during the pandemic, docs suspended any processing of marriage license applications. We talked about broadening the access to the family reunion program that would allow families to spend time together over about 36 hours and to strengthen family ties and relationships. We also talked about releasing people who were aging in prison, as I mentioned earlier. And we talked about shortening sentences. And we also talked about how do we deal with issues of forgiveness and harm and building a narrative that would allow space for people who had been convicted of very, very serious offenses to have a second chance at building a life and being contributing members to society. All of those required systemic change, and we were all about taking on those challenges.
Sophia Elijah, your story is so inspiring. If it's okay to ask you a personal question, how did you get involved in this work?
Well, my involvement in this work is both personal and professional. I've had incarcerated loved ones in my life since I was age 17. That's quite a few decades ago. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a criminal defense lawyer, and I would see what was happening with my clients and their families and how the plight of incarceration for people was tearing their families and their communities apart. The communities that were being torn apart are the communities that I came from. And I would go, when I would go to visit incarcerated loved ones, I would see many other people from my neighborhood who had just disappeared from my neighborhood, but there they were in prison. And so that mattered to me. And I always felt that my responsibility as someone who'd been fortunate enough to get a college education and then a law school education was to use that education to serve my community. And there was no better place for me than to do the work that I do and have been doing for a long time.
Sophia Elijah, how do you see the Alliance for Families for Justice? What do you see them doing 2 and 5 years from now? Where do you see your landing then?
Our plans for the Alliance of Families for Justice include expanding our reach across New York State. We're a statewide organization, and we've been opening satellite offices in key areas of the state. So right now, we have a satellite office in Ithaca and one in Albany. We envisioned opening one in the Western Region and in the Hudson Valley. And we'll continue to expand not only in New York State, but what we do is needed not only here, but across the country. So we've been asked by many states if we would open a branch in those states. So we're also considering expansion to other states. And I guess if you gave me a 10-year timeline, Michael, I would say by that time we'll be all over the country.
That's for sure. That would be great.
Sophia Elijah, how can people follow the work of AFJ and get involved themselves?
You can follow us on our website, which is afj-ny.org. People can certainly follow us on social media at AFJNY. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I'm sure we're on some other outlets. I can't keep up with all of them, but those are the main ones. People can get involved. They can email us at info@afj-ny.org. They can call us at 347-973-0580. They can write to us at 8 West 126th Street, 3rd floor, New York, New York, 10027. We are available. We have meetings every week. Our family support unit, our community organizing meeting. We have monthly meetings for formerly incarcerated people in Ithaca. We have weekly meetings for formerly incarcerated men and formerly incarcerated women. We provide, as I mentioned earlier, free legal services, and we have a robust youth empowerment project that meets twice a week, for ages 16 to 24 that also provides a small stipend and is building leadership potential amongst our young people, because as we all know, our future is in our youth.
Sophia Elijah, before I thank you, could you also tell our listeners how they can get in touch with RAP, Release Aging People from Prison?
I would imagine the best way is to Google them, Michael. I don't have their contact information handy.
Well, that's exactly what people should do. Sophia Elijah, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
When Donald Trump became president in 2016, one of the most terrifying prospects was that he could signal a new era for the Supreme Court of the United States, where vacancies would be strategically filled to create one of the most conservative courts in nearly a century, which could roll back constitutional rights and liberties we've been taking for granted. Indeed, even though Donald Trump was not reelected in 2020, the conservative 6-3 majority that exists and the havoc they are wreaking could last for decades. While I'm sure Donald Trump would like to take all the credit, the battle to buy Supreme Court influence and push votes to the right long precedes his tenure as president. Our guest, Andrew Perez, has devoted his life and career to exposing the money, influence, and secret transactions among the most powerful people in the world to control the United States laws, governments, and people. He is an investigative reporter and senior editor for The Lever, which was just awarded the 2023 Izzy Award for Outstanding Achievement by Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College for its relentless work, quote, exposing the corrupting influence of corporate power on government and both major parties, end quote. In announcing the award, the Center for Independent Media highlighted Andrew's work for exposing the largest political donation in U.S. history, Chicago businessman Barry Saeed's $1.6 billion money transfer to conservative operative Leonard Leo, who served as Donald Trump's judicial advisor. And guess who Leonard Leo appears to be ready to back now? Republican presidential candidate Ron DeSantis. Andrew Perez has been prolific in uncovering and explaining dark money influence on the Supreme Court, as well as Medicare privatization and other dangers of deregulation. Andrew Perez, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So before we get into specifics, in broad strokes, can you explain who is Leonard Leo and why are his fingerprints all over changes in U.S. government leadership and policy? Whose interest does he represent?
Sure. So Leonard Leo is a longtime executive at the Federalist Society, which is the conservative lawyers network in Washington, D.C., that has served as sort of a launching pad or a springboard for Republicans looking for, jobs, for instance, in the Trump administration and also just all throughout sort of state offices. During the Trump presidency, Leo served as Trump's judicial advisor, helping him select three of the six Supreme Court justices. He also was apparently influential in helping select John Roberts and Sam Alito in the Bush administration. And he's also, for a number of years now, helped run this dark money network that has supported the Supreme Court justices, that boosted their confirmations. The network helped block Merrick Garland's nomination in 2016 under Barack Obama. They've also, this network also then funds organizations and politicians who are bringing precedent-shattering cases to the Supreme Court on a regular basis.
Andrew, let's talk about the U.S. Supreme Court. When it overturned Roe v. Wade last year, you co-wrote an article titled Dark Money Led Us to This Moment, and another one called How a Secretive Billionaire Handed His Fortune to the Architect of the Right-Wing Takeover of the Courts. We're talking about Leonard Leo. In your article, you explained how a small group of individuals, since at least 2005, when opportunistic Donald Trump was still a Democrat, by the way, by 2005, they launched a strategy to extinguish a constitutional right to abortion and pushed for a right-wing takeover of the court. Please summarize your findings for our listeners.
Yeah, so since 2005, Leonard Leo and his allies have been leading a dark money network to install right-wing justices on the Supreme Court and judges all throughout the judiciary. This network has really grown since then. It started, they were dealing with hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then, maybe single-digit millions of dollars. And then in 2016, they saw a giant influx of cash when it became time to block Merrick Garland's seat on the Supreme Court, prevent him from replacing Antonin Scalia. When Leo became Trump's judicial advisor, these efforts really kind of went into overdrive. They installed three very conservative Supreme Court justices in Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, justices who Leo helped pick, which his network then helped support with, tens of millions of dollars in spending in terms of public relations campaigns, TV campaigns. And then, what we learned last year, we reported this with ProPublica, is that Leonard Leo in 2020, 2021 became the beneficiary of basically the largest known dark money donation, political advocacy donation in U.S. history, where they, received effectively a $1.6 billion transfer courtesy of a conservative billionaire in Chicago named Barry Side. Side donated his entire business empire into, which was in the electronics business, selling surge protectors, that kind of thing. Side donated that business to a nonprofit run by Leo, which then sold it for $1.6 billion, creating the biggest known dark money donation in U.S. history. If Side had sold it himself, it could have been, he might have owed $400 million in taxes. Instead, there were no taxes on the sale because it went through a nonprofit, effectively creating a very large public subsidy for Leo's conservative enterprise.
Well, that is exasperating, yes. And let's talk about yet another billionaire in the club. When the news broke last month about Texas real estate billionaire Harlan Crow bestowing multi-million-dollar gifts and benefits to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and his family, you co-wrote another article with David Sirota called "Here's the Real Goal of Supreme Court Corruption." You surveyed U.S. history and explained why lifetime appointments were originally so important. Talk to us about this, please.
Yeah, well, so, what we found was there's data showing that the Supreme Court justices, as they age, became more liberal. And this was sort of, I think, for many years, a really kind of central cause for concern among conservatives. They do all this work, putting conservative justices on the court, only to find that they become, more liberal, given the sort of independence that you think you get on the Supreme Court, right? Like, that's sort of the whole basis here with these lifetime appointments, is that they're supposed to be insulated from outside influence and pressure, because no one's going to fire them, right? Like, and they're in a position of extreme power. It's our sort of supposition that that what we're seeing, in the stories that have been trickling out, reported in large part by ProPublica, that Clarence Thomas has, been the beneficiary of, two decades worth of sort of luxury gifts from Harlan Crow, the Texas conservative mega donor, going on these very fancy vacations, private jet travel, super yachts. And then, we also then learned, thanks to ProPublica, that that Crow also bought property from Clarence Thomas, the house where his mom has lived. It has allowed her to continue living there rent-free, and also paid for the tuition of Clarence Thomas's grandnephew, who it sounds like he was raising as effectively his adopted son. We've learned a lot more kind of since then. There's been reporting from Insider about how John Roberts' wife was making millions of dollars as a headhunter, placing lawyers at firms with business before the court. We learned that Neil Gorsuch sold property to the head of a law firm with a lot of business before the court. There's also been reporting about how George Mason University, where Leonard Leo has a lot of influence, has been, paying justices maybe $20,000 to $25,000 a year to teach what effectively sounds like these like big vacations to Italy and Iceland, that kind of thing. Oh yeah, and there was also reporting about, I believe from the Washington Post, about how Leonard Leo had steered consulting payments to Ginny Thomas, to Justice Clarence Thomas's wife. So yeah, basically, and this is on top of there's a million conferences that these justices get invited to, get traveled and get flown out to, the Federalist Society, the Conservative Lawyers Network that Leo's part of, pays to bring the ship judges all around the country to talk to students, that kind of thing, at classes and events for FedSoc, that. Basically, our point here is that there's a very lucrative and luxurious and comfortable life that gets afforded to justices who retain their sort of status within the conservative legal movement, who continue to share in the conservative beliefs that the broader movement has. If they were to ever kind of stray from that, they would lose a lot. They would lose a lot of comfort and luxury you know, we think that this sort of that they've been ensconced in a sort of perfect, you know, corruption bubble to keep them not just from getting more liberal, but actually, you know, getting increasingly hardline conservative in the judiciary.
We're speaking with Andrew Perez on the corruption in the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary. I'm Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, attorney Maria Hall, and we're delighted to have Andrew. Andrew, let's talk some more about Clarence Thomas. On May 9th, you wrote an article about him, and you discussed how he reversed his own legal opinion of 10 years ago after getting all these extravagant gifts from Harlan Crow. Talk about the decision, please, that Clarence Thomas reversed himself on, evidently in exchange for these lavish gifts.
I don't think we would ever kind of try to lay out an explicit quid pro quo, but, you know, it does seem to us really, you know, kind of fascinating because, you know, one of the main defenses of Clarence Thomas and, you know, in the wake of all these reports about the money that he's, you know, the money and gifts that he's, you know, been receiving courtesy of Harlan Crow is, a lot of conservatives have been like, all right, well, show us the quid pro quo, right? Like, show us, you know, any evidence that he's changed his views on anything. You know, as we point out in this article, Clarence Thomas has changed his position on, you know, one of the most kind of important administrative legal doctrines, which is called the Chevron doctrine or Chevron deference. And it's the idea that the executive branch, not the federal courts, has the power to interpret laws passed by Congress. In some circumstances, this has become a real thorn in the side of the conservative legal movement. It's a decision that was originally seen as a win for polluters, but it has ended up giving a lot of it's given the administrative state more power or ability to actually flesh out laws passed by Congress, to actually implement them. And so, yeah, it's a big problem for conservatives. And it's an area where Clarence Thomas had originally written, you know, opinion citing the Chevron deference doctrine, you know, relying on it, approving it. And now he's, you know, changed his mind in the last couple of years, come around to the idea that the doctrine might have always been unconstitutional. And as we point out in this article, you know, a bunch of nonprofits that have been funded by the Leo Network are, you know, also gunning to throw out Chevron deference. And then Harlan Crow, some nonprofits that he and his wife have funded, are also attempting to overturn this at the Supreme Court. And there's a case that the court just accepted recently, and we'll hear next term on this topic, I believe.
Let's turn now to another issue you're quite familiar with, the debt ceiling. Last week, you co-wrote an article called Dark Money's Behind the Debt Ceiling Plan to Punish the Poor. I don't think it's a coincidence that Leonard Leo once again figures prominently into this picture. What were some of the punishments to which you were referring, and from where did the ideas arise?
Sure. So Republicans in the fight over the debt ceiling, you know, they've been looking to basically hold the debt limit hostage, you know, basically threaten default, threaten a U.S. government default in exchange for some sort of spending cuts. And then they've also been pushing for these sort of punishing work requirements to be added and expanded on social safety net programs. You know, the main one that I think maybe the worst one in there that doesn't look like it's in the deal, fortunately, was they wanted to impose work requirements on Medicaid, which is the health insurance, the government health insurance program for the poor. That doesn't look like it's in there in this deal, but there are some new expanded work requirements being added to the food stamp program, as well as the federal cash assistance program known as temporary assistance to needy families. And as we lay out in this article, these have kind of long been the, you know, brainchild of this organization called the Foundation for Government Accountability, which has been funded by the Leo Network, as well as by Dick Uihlein, who is If you ever get cardboard boxes, you're probably paying the Uline family. So anyway, the Foundation for Government Accountability and its sort of lobbying arm have been pushing for new work requirements to be added to all of these programs for many years. And you know, they've been actively kind of cheering it on, and they've been using this sort of same, you've heard the same arguments coming from FGA and House Republicans about work sets people free from dependency and that kind of thing. There's no real data showing that's true at all. There's no real data showing that if people face, you know, these kind of barriers in retaining their federal benefits, there's no real evidence that it makes people, you know, any more likely to work. The data shows that what actually happens is those type of work requirements add barriers, administrative barriers to actually retaining coverage, like Medicaid coverage. That's all it really would do is effectively throw millions of people off of Medicaid.
Yeah. And meanwhile, they haven't said anything about raising taxes on rich people to cover the debt. They haven't talked about lowering the military budget to cover the debt. And instead, they're taking it out on poor people. One of the ways they're taking it out on poor people is the Joe Manchin pipeline that's going through Virginia and West Virginia. And they're going to allow that thing to happen. And what I read is that it's going to be the equivalent in pollution of 19 million cars or 26 coal-powered plants. And they don't even talk about that. Instead, they're trying to take away money for food stamps for poor people. This is really a disaster.
Yep.
Okay, and once again on the subject of the debt ceiling, it appears Medicare won't be scrutinized in this most recent budget debate. And I'm talking about Medicare, not Medicaid. At first, I thought, great. But then I read your article published on Friday called The $20 Billion Scam at the Heart of Medicare Advantage. Now I realize I was naive to assume the government simply takes each dollar earmarked for Medicare to directly help those in need, namely people over 65 and some younger people with disabilities. But that's not exactly the case, is it?
Yeah. Well, so the government, you know, the Medicare Advantage program, which is the private plans operated by corporate health insurers, this program has become a real cash cow for health insurers in the past few years. There's a lot of data showing how these plans are incredibly lucrative for health insurers. And what we looked at here is, you know, there have been efforts by the Biden administration and going back before them too, just to attempt to claw back some overpayments that have been going to Medicare Advantage plans. Effectively, these plans are systematically overbilling the government as if their patients are much sicker than they are. They have managed to hold on to most of these overpayments, especially recently. They basically got the Biden administration to back off some of their proposals, to reduce the scope of some of the proposals, to claw back the overpayments, to prevent future overpayments. And, you know, they launched a very large lobbying blitz early this year to attempt to beat back some of the proposals. And they were pretty successful. And as we point out here, these overpayments are really driving the profits of some of these health insurance companies. You know, if Humana wasn't pocketing these overpayments, they might have lost money last year instead of making $2.8 billion. And you know, that's sort of what you kind of see throughout the corporate health insurance industry right now.
Andrew Perez, do these dark money groups have anyone or any institution seriously challenging their efforts to privatize everything? I mean, I'm thinking now of they even privatized parking meters in Chicago. Privatize everything that they can control, every branch of the U.S. government. For example, you wrote last fall about the Disclose Act. What was that all about?
Sure. Well, so the Disclose Act is a legislation that Democrats put forth and, you know, after the Citizens United decision. So they've been pushing this for over a decade. They've never managed to pass it through. They've allowed Republicans to filibuster it anytime they've actually had a chance to pass the legislation, including again last fall. The Republicans filibustered it. Conservative Democrats refused to eliminate the filibuster, obviously, so it failed yet again, despite having the support of the whole Democratic caucus. But you know, the Disclose Act would just force dark money groups to disclose their donors, to force these politically active nonprofits to say who's funding them, including the groups that are invested in the Supreme Court fights. So, you know, it's really important common sense legislation to helping people understand the effect, the influence of dark money. And it has been blocked for, you know, more than a decade now. And that's looks like it's going to continue.
Wow. Well, in our last moments here, I think that just emphasizes how important your work is and getting this information out there. Can you just tell us in our last minute or so, what are the stories to watch? And most importantly, where can listeners read more about you and your work and The Lever?
Sure. You know, I think Leonard Leo is one of the most important people to be following right now, just because he's sitting on an unprecedented amount of cash and has, you know, managed to influence public policy in this country with far less in the past. I think the Medicare Advantage story is really important because this year, more than half of Medicare beneficiaries will be on these private plans, on the Medicare Advantage plans, instead of traditional Medicare for the first time. So, you know, that story is really important. And, you know, if health insurance companies are allowed to continue bilking the system, it has sweeping financial effects for everyone, and in addition to just, you know, those plans might not cover all you think they cover. there are rampant denials within there that where plans are denying services that Medicare would, that traditional Medicare would cover. So I think that's a really important story to follow. And you know, these are stories that we're trying to cover all the time at The Lever. Our website is levernews.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Andrew Perez, DC.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Andrew Perez, senior editor and reporter for The Lever, covering money and influence. We need more independent journalists like you. Thank you so much again for joining us, and we hope to have you again soon.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. We'll be right back.
Waiting on a train station, waiting for that train. Take me away from this lonesome town. Glad you don't love me no more, girl.
Could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a once-over.
We all want our kids to grow up safe and healthy, so we show them how. And we tell them, with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. Not just one time, but every chance we get. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. Kids not only need to know the dangers and how to avoid them, they need to hear it often from you. And when it comes to pain medications, opioids, they need to know that they should never be taken without a prescription and never shared with friends or family. It's dangerous and illegal. So talk with your kids and guide them through the challenges of growing up safe and healthy. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
So talk, they hear you. You can do it if you try.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nazism draws from a deeper wellspring of Western ideas. The Nazis didn't just look at the Jim Crow law and segregation, they also studied American race law, American law to do with indigenous people, American colonial law, and laws around marriage and property as well. The actual policymakers of the Nazi regime learned a lot from the United States because America was the world leader of race law at that time. And at times, the Nazis actually thought American law around the one-drop rule and other forms of segregation was actually too harsh. And in the end, Nazi lawyers and jurists rejected American race law for being too extreme.
That's Omer Aziz, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Omer Aziz on fascism in America. The term fascism is loosely bandied about. When most people think of it, the images that come to mind are of stormtroopers and Hitler ranting and raving. It's often automatically assumed that fascism developed in Europe in the 1920s, but it had its origins earlier in the United States. The United States was built on genocidal attacks on indigenous people, white supremacy, and enslaved black people. Actually, Hitler and the Nazis were greatly impressed and inspired by American fascism. Though the term was not used, the United States had developed a sophisticated system of aggressive nationalism, racism, and oppression. In other words, fascism. It lingers in the shadows and reappears, as is evident today. Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, and other groups are fascist. They fear social equality as a threat to patriarchal white supremacist domination. To talk about fascism in America is Omer Aziz. He's a writer, journalist, lawyer, and former foreign policy advisor in the administration of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He has clerked for the United Nations Special Envoy for Syria. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and many other publications. He spoke at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts in mid-April. And now, Omer Aziz.
Thank you to all of you for joining me today. You know, before I start, but I do want to answer the question of why I even pursued this project. You see, when I was growing up, I was told a lot of myths about the West, that it was the bastion of the Enlightenment and the age of reason and of civilized society. And I agreed with a lot of that. I went to some of the best schools. I'm here at Harvard. But I never quite understood how it was that the West, about 90 years ago, had sent its most assimilated, its most productive minority to the gas chambers. How had that happened? How had it happened that civilized, enlightened societies like Germany and like Italy had descended into the worst forms of barbarism and savagery that we had seen? Perhaps the roots of the problem didn't start in 1930. Perhaps the roots of this ideology we call fascism went a little deeper. And perhaps it was here in America as well. But before we understand what's going on right now, I think we need to take it all the way back. I want to lay out a definition very quickly because I think this is a core point that critics will jump on. Well, fascism is a term that everyone uses. It's used in online discourse.